Actually, she says, the knowledge of higher beings can be received more accurately with the help of electronic equipment than with the mind of a single individual. Another thing that makes communication difficult with celestial beings is that they have a non-human perspective and human reactions are frequently alien to them. When souls pass into the fourth plane, few of them are interested in contacting the earth plane anymore. The technician says that beings on the fourth plane have feelings, but they are no longer comparable with human feelings. Salter mentions that Mahatma Gandhi and Albert Schweitzer have gone beyond the fourth, higher astral level and are now on the fifth, mental causal plane. They are no longer interested in physical beings and have fulfilled their tasks toward mankind. The technician and Salter speak of the being Pescator, who is known on Earth as Jesus Christ. He is one of the few higher beings who has access to all the planes and still maintains contact with men on Earth. The technician and Salter emphasize that Pescator is not an earthly personality structure. He is capable of appearing in a human body, but he is not human and he is a differently structured personality. Salter, the director of Time Stream, was assigned the project of developing the lab on the third plane by Pescator and she meets with him, and six other higher beings, periodically to review the lab's progress. On one occasion, she took the physician Paracelsus with her to the great conference room in the heavens where council meetings are held, in a particularly beautiful room. The ceiling was a cupola in which numerous stars were shining brightly. Those stars were bigger and more luminous than the stars in your sky. The room turned on its axis. Salter said the technician asked her to present the suggestions of humans and report about ITC. It was difficult for her because of the higher being's non-human perspective. As she says, human reactions are frequently alien to them. Also, they hold back things from her, feeling that humans do not need to know everything because the background of events and some information would be beyond their comprehension. Some events in life are tied up with past lives and future experiences and a great deal of confusion might occur if humans had too much information. She says that what is amazing about celestial beings is their sincerity. They have no secrets from one another. They interact like a network of computers, exchanging information as fast as a computer bank. If you speak to one of the higher beings, then all of the others are simultaneously aware of the conversation. All of them are aware of your entire personality, too. She goes on to say that, as they have no secrets from each other, the only way one can get closer to them is by being absolutely sincere. Insincerity is alien to them. Nothing remains hidden in their dimension. You forget in your world that sincerity plays a most important part over here. Salter says that higher beings take on the attitude of a grown-up towards a little child who cannot understand yet. Yet human beings today are not like little children anymore. They have evolved and expanded in knowledge. Salter found that she had to learn to approach higher beings and convince them that she really, sincerely, wanted to communicate with them. And they, too, had to recognize that man's understanding had expanded enough that it was worth communicating with man. When Paracelsus met the higher being Pescator, he said, he is a being of such pure light that it is almost blinding to look at him and of such divine beauty that tears rolled down my eyes. Salter goes on to say of Pescator that he has many personalities or aspects. The man on earth called Jesus Christ is only one personality among others who belong to the entity Pescator. Pescator told her that should Time Stream be faced with a decision to help the sick and needy or to totally concentrate on improving technical aspects of ITC, then, Time Stream's support and help for the needy should come first. So, although Time Stream is a scientific endeavor, humanitarian concerns must take precedence over scientific concerns. Salter explains that very little is known all about the celestial planes, the planes of God, and that once one has reached these planes, one is never heard from again. A Time Stream contact coming over the radio describes the present life as just a fraction of a moment. He says, the states of consciousness are very different here, but it is no reason to feel sad about it. A friendly world waits for all of us on the mid-astral and higher planes. But if the higher planes offer a chance for friendship, loving companionship, a chance to grow and change, the lower planes hold man in a deadly noose of desire and negative behavior patterns. Dante's Inferno describes the various circles of hell: lust, greed, anger, hatred, and malice. Even though he was writing in the medieval time, he was not inaccurate. If hell is man's vices and addictions, human nature hasn't changed much. The lower part of the astral plane, because of its heavy vibrations, is closest to the earth. When a person dies, he or she goes to that part of the astral plane which is in accord with his or her emotional desires. The astral plane is created so that people with similar goals and similar emotional patterns are together. If a person is preoccupied with sex, there is a part of the lower plane where he or she can work out this negative desire. Not that sex is negative, but when the person is totally obsessed with sex, it becomes a vice. Robert Monroe, who regularly travels the astral plane, describes many of the locales as focuses and once found himself on the sex plane. He says that he saw what looked to be a pile of maggots. On coming closer, he found hundreds of humans swarming over each other. He tried to pull one man out by the foot, but the fellow was so engrossed in sex, he stubbornly refused to talk to Monroe and burrowed more deeply into the pile. Many alcoholics and cigarette smokers find themselves trapped on the lower plane as well. Their preoccupation leads them to hang around bars on Earth so they can vicariously pick up the effects of alcohol and cigarette fumes. They attach themselves to the auric field, an electromagnetic field surrounding each person, like a parasite, trying to absorb into themselves the alcohol and nicotine. However, since they do not have a physical body, it becomes a hellish experience, like a thirsty man trying to drink water that is beyond his reach. Many of these people free themselves of their unpleasant reality by undergoing rehabilitation processes on the mid-astral plane. The point is, that if we don't clean up our difficult habits and addictions on Earth, we'll have to do it later. Some people become earthbound after they die. For example, a man or woman so preoccupied by a house he or she has built, will hang around it in spirit, and the people living in that house might sense the spirit and will speak of ghosts. Similarly, if the preoccupation is with a family member, for example a mother with a son, the mother will try to remain in contact with her son and not move up into the higher realms. Dr. George Ritchie witnessed earthbound souls during his trip to the astral plane. In his book, Return from Tomorrow, he tells of an experience he had when he was 20 years old. He was pronounced dead of double lobar pneumonia by an orderly and two doctors. 9 minutes later, he returned to life. During that time he saw Christ, who took him on a guided tour of the astral plane. On the lowest part of the plane, which is closest to the earth, Ritchie described insubstantial beings standing in a bar on earth, crowding around a drunken sailor, and greedily following each swallow he made. All at once, Ritchie saw a bright cocoon around the sailor open up and began peeling away from his head and shoulders. A moment later, one of the insubstantial beings jumped inside the sailor. Ritchie witnessed the same scene several times again with other men who were drinking. Each time, one of the insubstantial beings vanished into one of the men. Ritchie realized that the insubstantial beings had developed an alcohol dependency that went beyond death. Now, even though they were dead, they hung around bars, hoping to take possession of anyone drinking so they could experience the effects of alcohol. As long as they craved alcohol, they were in a hell of craving. Later, inside a house, he saw a boy in an insubstantial body standing in front of his mother and father, saying, "I'm sorry, Ma. I'm sorry, Pa." But the man and woman could not hear him. Christ explained the boy was a suicide. Ritchie saw men who had murdered, now futilely boxing at each other, violent people who wanted to kill but could not because their intended victims were already dead. All of these were the earthbound, chained to earth by their addictions or vices, by hate and anger, chained to a world of which they were no longer a part. Now, these murderers were all together in a place where they kept trying to murder each other. He had imagined hell as a fiery place below the earth where men burned. Now he saw that they burned from their addictions and former destructive actions. I, Pate Cubise, can confirm Richie's accounts. For many years in out-of-body trips, I traveled the astral plane, too. On one occasion, I was shown the lowest part of the plane where murderers live. It was subhuman. The spirits there no longer looked like normal human beings. They were gross and deformed, and the atmosphere was very dense, almost black. I witnessed the liberation of one of these spirits. He seemed to be incarcerated in a muddy substance with several other spirits. I asked the spirit, "What did you do?" It answered, "I killed. I was a murderer." This was said with much anguish. Then, a rescuer touched the spirit. The incarcerated spirit rose from the mud and the rescuer took its hand and they both left for a higher plane. On another occasion I saw the sex plane. The locale was very dark and dim. It seemed to be a huge brothel with many, many cubicles where men and women engaged in sex on beds. Yet only a few feet away, I saw the rescuers waiting for those spirits who finally were freed from their preoccupation. As George Ritchie saw, suicides roam the lower planes, too. There is no escape from life. You cannot escape your life or your problems by death. When you die, you still have a body, an astral body, and you are still confronted by your same problems and emotions. The technician says, avoiding work and responsibility in this world is only delaying the learning process. This is also true for those who are tempted to escape to a nicer world by taking their own life. He says again and again that there is no escaping any personal problems. If you don't solve them now on Earth, they will be waiting for you on the next plane. Merely dying doesn't solve mental anguish and pain. Another group of people trapped in the lower planes are those who have been killed in an accident and are traumatized, unable to leave the scene of the accident. Many psychics have reported the accident victim hovering over his or her lifeless body and trying futilely to talk to those people trying to help. In all of these cases, the alcohol/cigarette/sex-addicted, the murderers and the violent, the earthbound, there are rescuers standing by, waiting, until the spirit has worked the attachment out of its consciousness. Then the rescuers are able to attract its attention and take the spirit to the higher realms of the astral plane. Many of the spirits on the third plane choose this task of rescuing spirits as their work. Buddha advised people to want nothing as the path to the spirit's freedom, and Earth is the place to free the self from any harmful addiction. Miltonia M.S. Satan said, "Where I am is hell." ITC workers, Ritchie and Monroe, confirm Milton. We put ourselves in hell through allowing negative habit patterns to control us. But hell is not permanent. Only moments away or sometimes years awaits a kind, compassionate soul, eager to help. No soul is in hopeless isolation on even the lowest of the astral planes. The technician says, the beyond, mid-astral planes, represents only one step of post-mortal existence. There are six other steps and the first one represents a huge nebulous region in which you wander about alone, should you have left the world by suicide or through other lowly motives. Those who believe in the theory of illusion, who claim mind and spirit totally dissolve when they leave your world, are wrong. Just the opposite. There are spirits who live in this nebulous world, the lower astral plane, between Earth and the beyond. The choice between heaven and hell is yours. Allowing any negative attitude or desire to take over condemns you to a lower plane in the astral world. There is no light and love thee, only pain and anguish. You will go to where you deserve to go. Many people have heard these words from ministers and priests, but ITC confirms it. The dead are now able to communicate via telephone, TV and computer to tell us exactly what the next world is like. Your choice is important. It determines the next phase of your eternal existence. No one knows exactly when he is going to die. Perhaps the Tibetan lamas offer the best advice on dying: think only of God at that last moment. For when you die, your thoughts and feelings sentence you to the place you deserve on the astral plane. 8. Instrumental transcommunication, the beginnings. In 1901, U.S. ethnologist Waldemar Borgres traveled to Siberia to visit a shaman of the Chukchi tribe. In a darkened room, he observed a spirit-conjuring ritual. The shaman beat a drum more and more rapidly, putting himself in a trance state. Startled, Borgres heard strange voices filling the room. The voices seemed to come from all comers and spoke in English and Russian. At first, Borgres wondered if the shaman was using ventriloquism. But how could he produce so many voices at once? Borgres decided to do a controlled experiment. He asked the shaman to come to his room where he could record the strange phenomena. After the session, Borgres wrote, "I set up my equipment so I could record without light." The shaman sat in the furthest corner of the room, approximately 20 feet away from me. When the light was extinguished, the spirits appeared after some hesitation and, following the wishes of the shaman, spoke into the horn of the phonograph. The recording showed a clear difference between the speech of the shaman, audible in the background, and the spirit voices, which seemed to have been located directly at the mouth of the horn. All along, the shaman's ceaseless drum beats can be heard as if to prove that he remained in the same spot. This experiment was the first in which voices of conjured spirits were recorded on an electrical one recording device. One Scientific American, October 30, 1920. In the 1920s, Thomas Alva Edison, inventor of the electric light, motion picture camera and phonograph, was busily at work in his laboratory constructing a machine to achieve spirit communication with the dead. Edison told the Scientific American, "If our personality survives, then it is strictly logical or scientific to assume that it retains memory, intellect, and other faculties and knowledge that we acquire on this earth. Therefore, if personality exists after what we call death, it's reasonable to conclude that those who leave the earth would like to communicate with those they have left here. I am inclined to believe that our personality hereafter will be able to affect matter. If this reasoning be correct, then, if we can evolve an instrument so delicate as to be affected, or moved, or manipulated by our personality as it survives in the next life, such an instrument, when made available, ought to record something." Edison's assistant, Dr. Miller Hutchinson, wrote, "Edison and I are convinced that in the fields of psychic research will yet be discovered facts that will prove of greater significance to the thinking of the human race than all the inventions we have ever made in the field of electricity." The mentalist Dunningi claims he saw the instrument Edison built, and a engineer also claims to have worked on it. Unfortunately, Edison died before he could complete his invention. Mrs. Edison told Norman Vincent Peale, author of Power of Positive Thinking, that when her husband died, he remarked to his physician, "It is very beautiful over there." Peale commented that Edison was a scientist, very factual, and as a scientist would never have reported "it is very beautiful over there" unless he believed it to be true. Then, in the early 1958 AMS in Italy, two Catholic priests, Father Ernetti and Father Gemelli, were collaborating on music research. Gemelli was president of the Papal Academy and Ernetti, an internationally respected scientist, physicist and philosopher, was also a music lover. They worked together in a physics lab with oscilloscopes, filter systems and other electronic gear in an effort to find ways to produce clearer singing voices. For years, Father Gemelli had often silently called upon his deceased father for advice when he faced crisis situations. He'd never received a conscious reply from his father, but things seemed to work out. It was one of those reassuring rituals that everyone uses to get through tough times. Or so he thought. On September 15, 1952, while Gemelli and Ernetti were recording a Gregorian chant, a wire on their magnetophone kept breaking. Exasperated, Father Gemelli looked up and asked his father for help. To the two men's amazement, his father's voice, recorded on the magnetophone, answered, "Of course I shall help you. I'm always with you." The two men stared at each other shocked. Father Gemelli began to shake. Sweat broke out on his forehead. Was this the devil? But Father Ernetti's scientific curiosity was piqued. He calmed Gemelli. "Come, come, let us try the experiment again. They did. This time, a very clear voice filled with humor said, "But Zucchini, it is clear, don't you know it is I?" Father Gemelli stared at the tape. No one knew the nickname his father had teased him with when he was a boy. He realized then that he was truly speaking with his father. Though his joy at his father's apparent survival was mixed with fear. Did he have any right to speak with the dead? Eventually the two men visited Pope Pius XII in Rome. Father Gemelli, deeply troubled, told the Pope of the experience. To his surprise, the Pope patted his shoulder. "Dear Father Gemelli, you really need not worry about this. The existence of this voice is strictly a scientific fact and has nothing whatsoever to do with spiritism. The recorder is totally objective. It receives and records only sound waves from wherever they come. This experiment may perhaps become the cornerstone for a building for scientific studies which will strengthen people's faith in a hereafter." 1 Italian journal Astra, June 1990. The good father was somewhat reassured. But he made certain that the experiment did not go public until the last years of his life. It wasn't until 1990 that the results were published. In 1956, two California men, Atlevance Zarley and Raymond Bayless, captured paranormal voices on audio tape. They reported their results in the Journal of the American Society for Psychical Research in the winter of 1959. The announcement was virtually ignored in the US. Neither the society nor the authors received a single response from readers. In 1959, the man who was to become a great pioneer in the recording of voice phenomena, Swedish film producer Fredrik Jensen, captured voices on tapes while taping bird songs. He was startled when he played the tape back and heard a male voice say something about bird voices in the night. Listening more intently to his tapes, he heard another voice, that of his deceased mother, say in German, "Friedrich, you are being watched. Friedel, my little Friedel, can you hear me?" Jensen said that when he heard his mother's voice, he was convinced he had made an important discovery. During the next 4 years, Jensen continued to tape hundreds of paranormal voices. He played the tapes at an international press conference and in 1964 published a book in Swedish, Voices from the Universe, and then another entitled Radio Contact with the Dead. He was a good friend of Pope Paul VI, having done a documentary film about him, and shared his research with him. The Vatican was so impressed, it authorized its own research people. Reverend Father Leo Schmid, a Swiss theologist, was given permission by his superiors to collect the voices and since 1969 has taped over 10,000 of them. Official authorization to conduct research into paranormal recordings was also given to Father Andreas Riesch, who began a course in parapsychology at the Vatican School for Priests in Rome. Father Pistone, superior of the Society of St. Paul in England, stated in interviews and on TV that he didn't see anything dangerous in the voices. After all, the Church has always held there is life after death. If the dead were able to contact us, then, it is a matter which is under the power of God because the departed are under his power also. 1 Handbook of Psi Discoveries, p. 266-277. Bistone believes that, at the moment, the voices are a phenomenon and they need to be studied, and he indicated that the Church would keep a close check on the research being done. Pope Pius' cousin, Dr. Gebhard Frey, co-founder of the Jung Institute and an internationally known parapsychologist, stated that, "Everything I have read and heard forces me to the supposition that only the hypothesis of the voices belonging to transcendental personalities has any chance of explaining the full scope of these phenomena." 2 Ibid.com pages 272-273. He added, "Whether it suits me or not, I have no right to doubt the reality of the voices." In 1970, the International Society for Catholic Parapsychologists held a conference in Austria and a major part of that conference was concerned with papers on voice phenomena. In Ireland and England, many TV shows discussed the tapes. Investigators examined the evidence and concluded the tapes were genuine and had not been tampered with. The publicity about the voices encouraged thousands of people all over the world to sit up at night with their tape recorders and to collect their own voices. The process was not complicated and many were successful. Jensen said that he had found a sympathetic ear for the voice phenomenon in the Vatican. I have won many wonderful friends among the leading figures in the Holy City. 3. Today the communication bridge stands firmly on its foundations. As Jensen indicated, many churchmen saw, or rather experienced, at the early audio research and were convinced it was genuine. The Right Reverend Monsignor, Professor C. Fledger comments, "Facts have made us realize that between death and resurrection, there is yet another realm of post-mortal existence. Christian theology has little to say about this realm. His Excellence, Archbishop H. E. Cardinal, Apostolic Nuncio to Belgium commented, "Naturally it is all very mysterious, but we know the voices are there for all to hear them." A. Maurice Barbanel, editor of Psychic News remarked, "The future lies with instruments capable of recording vibrations or radiation emanating from the spirit world which are not normally receptive to man's five senses." In 1967, Jensen's radio contact with the dead was translated into German, and Latvian psychologist, Dr. Konstantin Rodive read it. Rodive was fascinated with the idea of contacting the dead, but he was skeptical. He decided to visit Jensen to learn his methodology. Impressed, Rodive soon began developing his own experimental techniques. Like Jensen, he, too, heard the voice of his own deceased mother, who called him by his boyhood name, "Kostiulet, this is your mother." Rodive conducted his experiments under strict laboratory conditions. He codified the principles and techniques relating to this new field, EVP, electronic voice phenomena. It was Rodive who discovered that spirits needed white noise, a vibration, or carrier sound which they could modulate into voice patterns strong enough to be captured on tape. Now it was evident why Bogera's shaman had used drum beats to provide the carrier sound. Rodive found that the white noise between radio stations produced a rich spectrum of frequencies that spirit voices could manipulate into voices. His book, Breakthrough, An Amazing Experiment in Electronic Communication with the Dead, revealed his startling research. However, scientists and electronic engineers remained skeptical of Rodive's work. Rodive's voices were different from human voices. They differed in pitch, amplification and intensity. The rhythm was irregular and had peculiar cadences. Rodive explained, "The sentence construction obeys rules that differ radically from those of ordinary speech, and although the voices seem to speak the same way we do, the anatomy of their speech apparatus must be different from our own." Only later did a spirit communicator reveal that spirits have no larynxes. No one disputed that the voices were actually on the tapes. But at first, sound engineers believed that the tapes were picking up radio and television transmissions. Rodive knew this wasn't true, because many of the voices addressed him by name. And he had thousands of tapes. In 1971, the chief engineers of Pi Records Limited decided to do a controlled experiment with Rodive. They invited him to their sound lab and installed special equipment to block out any radio and television signals. They would not allow Rodive to touch any of the equipment. Rodive used one tape recorder which was monitored by a control tape recorder. All he could do was speak into a microphone. The engineers taped Rodive's voice for 18 minutes and none of the experimenters heard any other sounds. But when they played back the tape, to their amazement, over 200 voices were heard and 27 of them were clear enough to be played back over a loudspeaker. The control monitor's tape was blank. What had happened was theoretically impossible. Two observers, publisher Sir Robert Meyer and his wife, Lady Meyer, received messages from a deceased friend, Arthur Schnabel, who spoke in German to them. Other voices directly addressed Rodive as "Kost your Kost," and Rodive's deceased sister said her name three times, "Tekel." Sir Robert was so elated by the experiment he agreed to publish a book on the subject. He jokingly remarked that he was relieved at the thought that eternity does not mean being condemned to eternal inactivity. perhaps the most powerful communication Rod I've received, out of almost 100,000 recordings, was a Latvian voice that said, "There is no death here. The earth is death." Also in 1971, the English company Billing and Lee, Limited, decided to conduct some experiments with Rod I've at their radio frequency screened laboratory.